Lecture 77, The Women's Movement.
Post-war America idealized families in which father worked outside the home and mother didn't. Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, published in 1963, showed that many middle-class women were bored by being confined to housework and mothering. Friedan's organization, the National Organization of Women, campaigned successfully for the abolition of gender discrimination in employment. In the late 1960s, women in the civil rights and anti-war movements, annoyed at being subordinated by their menfolk, created Women's Liberation, arguing by analogy to the civil rights movement that women too were a disadvantaged minority group. Their consciousness-raising work, their attacks on sexism in advertising and the media, and their criticism of gender bias in society and law gave rise to radical feminism. At its most militant, it turned men as a whole, as a group, into the enemy. In its more moderate form, it campaigned for the Equal Rights Amendment to the Constitution, the ERA. But feminists were dismayed to discover that the ERA's leading opponents were another group of women, Stop ERA, led by Phyllis Schlafly, who argued that women already enjoyed ideal conditions in America, and that the amendment would destroy public recognition of real differences between the sexes. Well, first of all, American women of the 1950s and 60s were probably the most privileged generation of women in the whole history of the world, but nevertheless, many of them felt that their lives were being wasted. Their material circumstances were certainly far more luxurious than those of any prior generation, and they had at their disposal a vast array of handy labor-saving devices. Better foods, better medical care, much greater cleanliness than had been possible earlier, refrigerators, televisions, vacuum cleaners, dishwashers, washing machines, and also, especially in the 50s, magazine articles about the way in which the even more automated kitchen of the future was going to make life even easier still. A great fervent enthusiasm for the perfect technological future in which hard work is abolished. But at the same time, those of them who had college degrees in particular, felt that their education was being underused and that they were being artificially hemmed in by social distinctions which no longer made sense. And the classic statement of this view came in Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique, published in 63. And it argued what one chapter's called The Problem That Has No Name. What had happened was that Betty Friedan herself had been a student at Smith College in the class of 1942, in other words, coming from a privileged minority. And after getting married and then keeping in touch with some of her college friends who'd gone through the same process, she found that many of them felt disappointed and stifled by living at home and working as full-time moms, that they had to live vicariously through others. They had to put too much store in sex, whereas their husbands had more variety in their lives. They were getting out into the world and doing important things. And she found that many of her friends were dependent on tranquilizers. Here's a famous quotation from Friedan's book. Quote, "Each suburban wife struggled with it alone. As she made the beds, shopped for groceries, matched slipcover material, ate peanut butter sandwiches with her children, chauffeured Cub Scouts and brownies, lay beside her husband at night, she was afraid even to ask herself the silent question, is this all?" Well, now, the women that she was talking about were, for the most part, the mothers of the big baby boom families. The American birth rate was very, very high in the late 40s and the 50s. But Friedan said, mothering alone is not sufficient. It doesn't justify the education they've had. These women ought to have the opportunity to enjoy important careers of their own. And she was emphatic on this point. It isn't just a matter of them getting jobs to earn money. It's a matter of them having careers to give them the gratification that comes from doing complex and fascinating work. Quote, "The only way for a woman, as for a man, to find herself, to know herself as a person, is by creative work of her own. There is no other way." And Friedan pointed out quite reasonably that as life expectancy increased, and it was increasing very rapidly in this period, women who married young often had all their kids in school by the time they themselves were in their early 30s, and could then look forward to another half century of life in which they ought to be doing something more stimulating. Now, it was true that at that time, prior to 1965, it was entirely legal to discriminate against women in employment, in other words, to specify that only men could apply for certain jobs. And in jobs where men and women both did them, it was also permissible to discriminate in pay, to pay the women less. Now, it's important to emphasise that Betty Friedan was aiming primarily at a middle-class readership. Working-class women, who were numerically greater, very often had to work and had had to work all the way through. The Second World War was a great moment for many of them because it provided employment opportunities after years of low employment. And they continued in the workforce, but for reasons of economic necessity rather than seeking the gratification of careers. But of course, that meant that any single woman who went into the workforce, whether because she'd never married or she'd become divorced, which was also more and more common by this period, tended to be at a severe economic disadvantage because women's work was less well paid. President Kennedy appointed a commission on the status of women in 1961. This predates Friedan's book. And its first head was Eleanor Roosevelt. She was the widow of President Franklin Roosevelt, the great leader of the New Deal era. And she herself was one of the great standard bearers of liberalism all through the middle of the 20th century. The report which the Kennedy Commission delivered in 1963 agreed that women were discriminated against in jobs, in payment, and in the law. Some states, even then in the 1960s, didn't let women sit on juries, and didn't let them make wills. Well, the women's movement took form in the 1960s in response to these perceived injustices, and later on developed. It started as a moderate procedural organisation, and later on picked up some more radical overtones. Friedan herself was the key figure in the creation of the National Organisation of Women, now founded in 1966. And it campaigned in the following years for the complete abolition of gender discrimination in employment, taking the view most of the jobs which currently exclude women aren't the kinds of jobs where brute physical strength is necessary. In other words, because women are intrinsically as intellectually capable as men, there's no adequate reason for them being excluded. And legislation passing through Congress in the early and mid-1960s gradually did include clauses preventing gender discrimination and stipulating equal pay for equal work. During the debates over the Civil Rights Acts, one Southern congressman who was dismayed at the way in which racial discrimination was becoming illegal, as a kind of irritable joke, said, "Oh, before you know it, we'll be having laws to prevent discrimination against women." Well, what started out as a kind of irritable joke was actually incorporated into the legislation and became standard from then on. The result was that in the 1960s, there was a sharp rise in the number of women entering the American workforce, particularly women entering in professional jobs, previously all male and previously high profile jobs. In the late 60s and 70s, as corporations came under pressure to include women, quite a lot of them reacted in the same way as Southern school districts had reacted to the demand for racial integration. That is, they used a tokenism policy. They'd have one woman in a senior and significant place, often in publicity, so that the corporation's image would be projected by an attractive woman. But gradually, from tokenism, the principle of routine hiring of women professionals did become established. And by the 1980s, the most sacrosanct areas were being changed. For example, President Reagan chose the first woman to be a Supreme Court Justice, Sandra Day O'Connor, partly to allay claims that he was an old-fashioned sexist. In 1984, for the very first time, one of the two major political parties, the Democrats, chose a woman as the running mate for their presidential candidate. Geraldine Ferraro was the running mate of Walter Mondale. One of the great issues, however, one of the great obstacles to women's entry into the workforce was the question of childcare. If a mother is going to work, what are her children going to do, especially her pre-school-age children? What are they going to do at the same time? So access to good quality childcare became and remained a very important issue among feminists. Should the government underwrite it, or was the private sector adequate to provide affordable childcare of the right kind? And more generally, was looking after the children intrinsically a women's job rather than a man's job? Ought not childcare duties to be shared equally among the two genders? Well, these were the questions which all feminists had to confront. But in the mid and late 1960s, women who were involved in the era's radical movements, particularly working for civil rights and then working in the anti-Vietnam War movement, became very critical of the gender discrimination they encountered among their male comrades. For example, in 1968, during one of the great student uprisings at Columbia University in New York, the student radicals occupied the administration building until the administration met their, what they called their non-negotiable demands. But it wasn't long before the girls there, the college girls, found that they were being made to do cooking and housework. So a group of them posted a sign which said, "Free women don't cook." And they insisted on the equal sharing between men and women of all the domestic duties. They had a vision of themselves as social revolutionaries, and they said, "We're changing everything. We're not just changing things like who does or doesn't go off to fight in the war. We're changing society at a more basic level." And they sought to oppose what they called sexism. It's a new word in the 60s, picking up the idea of racism and applying it to gender, sexism. They sought to oppose sexism and women's self-delusion by conducting consciousness-raising workshops. You see, what's unusual about feminism was this. Very often, they had to, the feminist leaders had to persuade other women that they were, in fact, victims of discrimination, even if they didn't feel as though they were. And consciousness-raising was the process of persuading women, you are, in fact, being victimized. It's very odd, isn't it? Usually, if you're the victim of persecution, you simply have no doubt about it at all. You haven't usually got to be persuaded of it. But here's a case where that's a little bit different. Women in consciousness raising groups were particularly counseled one another. We must avoid the bad old tradition of women thinking of each other as rivals for the affections of the men. We've got to have a solidarity among ourselves, sisterhood. And sisterhood is powerful was one of the great slogans of the women's movement. They denounced such conventional forms of female display as beauty contests, which they regarded as the very worst of this. And a radical feminist group called Witch picketed the Miss America pageant in 1968 in Atlantic City, carrying posters that said, "Miss America sells it." The implication that it's almost a form of prostitution to become involved in these beauty pageants, that women ought not to be evaluated on the basis of such frivolous externals as their appearance. And they themselves, the feminists themselves, compared themselves with other minority groups, in particular with the African-American population. They said, although it's true that we're not a numerical minority in the way that the African-American population is, in fact, there may even have been a slight majority, nevertheless, we're the victims of systematic discrimination, and in that sense, we're a minority. And, like other groups, they understood the symbolic importance of demonstrations. The great thing about a demonstration, of course, is that it brings lots of people together, gives them a collective feeling of righteous indignation. It's very, very good fun. They have a clearly identified target against whom they're demonstrating. And the sheer act of doing it brings in the media as well to give publicity to their cause and to help spread it. So, on August the 26th, 1970, which was the 50th anniversary of women getting the vote back in 1920, there was a New York women's strike, a New York housewives strike, and a women's march for equality in New York. They had a lovely slogan, too. "Don't iron while the strike is hot." Isn't that wonderful? A beautiful reversal of a famous, familiar saying. Now, among the slightly more radical feminists, the principal figure was Gloria Steinem. She was the co-founder in 1972 of Ms. magazine, MS. Ms. was a new title. The idea was, why is it that men should have only one title, Mr., whether or not they're married, whereas women should have two different ones, Miss if they're not married and Mrs. if they are? Let's have a neutral term, Ms., so that the same kind of invidious discrimination doesn't get made. And this became the name of the journal, produced by and for women. Earlier on, Gloria Steinem herself had been a freelance journalist who'd encountered what became known as the glass ceiling in journalism. She wanted to do serious political stories, but her editors were constantly pushing her off on what she regarded as frivolous and unworthy assignments. For example, most famously, Gloria Steinem went underground as a Playboy bunny and had to put on the silly bunny costume and the floppy ears and so on, and then write an expose about what it was really like being a bunny. Now, ironically, even though she became one of the most articulate spokes persons for the feminist movement. The mainstream media was very attracted to Gloria Steinem because she was beautiful. She was articulate, but she was also very, very striking in her appearance. And so the mainstream media, the New York Times and the Washington Post and the networks, would regularly ask Gloria Steinem for the women's view on these issues, with the result that something of a cult of personality grew up around her, very much to the bristling resentment of many other feminist leaders who didn't like the way in which the old convention of the beautiful woman getting the best of everything was being duplicated. A minority of radical feminists actually started to view the world as an arena for conflict between men and women. And perhaps the most dramatic example of this can be found in Susan Brown Miller's book, Against Our Will, published in 1975. Brown Miller's idea of society was this, that it is and has always been a conflict between men and women, and that the most sinister weapon in the men's arsenal is rape. That rape isn't a horrible aberration, a crime committed by a ghastly tiny minority. It's actually the standard operating procedure with which men encounter women and have encountered them throughout history. She admitted that not all men were rapists, but she said the men who are actually rapists do the kind of frontline work on behalf of all the others. It's an extremely bleak view of human interaction. But let me quote to you from her book. This is particularly her speculating on its ancient origins. So Susan Brown Miller. Quote, "The dim perception that had entered prehistoric woman's consciousness must have had an equal but opposite reaction in the mind of her male assailant. For if the first rape was an unexpected battle founded on the first woman's refusal, the second rape was indubitably planned. Indeed, one of the earliest forms of male bonding must have been the gang rape of one woman by a band of marauding men. This accomplished, rape became not only a male prerogative, but man's basic weapon of force against woman, the principal agent of his will and her fear. His forcible entry into her body, despite her physical protestations and struggle, became the vehicle of his victorious conquest over her being, the ultimate test of his superior strength, the triumph of his manhood. Man discovered that his genitalia could serve as a weapon in prehistoric times, along with the use of fire and the first crude stone axe. From prehistoric times to the present, I believe, rape has played a critical function. It is nothing more or less than a conscious process of intimidation by which all men keep all women in a state of fear." So she has this idea that all the men, especially the men who are not rapists, are living on the borrowed energy of the actual rapist. It's an extremely bleak view of the essential antagonism between men and women in the world. In the 1970s, one of the issues which caused great controversy within the feminist ranks was the question of lesbianism. If it was, in fact, the case that the men were the enemy, surely the very last thing you should be doing is consorting with the enemy. How do you do that if you crave companionship? Through lesbianism. And so the debate to which lesbianism was or was not normal and really represented a higher state of consciousness and being caused conflict inside the movement. Betty Friedan and the moderate feminists took the view, this is all nonsense. You're never going to be able to persuade the majority of women that they ought to be lesbians. No, clearly the majority of women are going to carry on marrying and wanting to marry. That doesn't mean that they ought not to have equal pay for equal work and so on. But let's not get distracted by this highly theoretical and ideological matter, which can only cause us harm rather than good. Well, the feminist movement coincided with what's called the sexual revolution, and it's no coincidence that it should have done too, because this was a period when questions about men's and women's proper roles and attitudes towards each other were heightened and were sort of very self-consciously scrutinized. The Kinsey Report on Male Sexuality in 1948 and the Kinsey Report on Female Sexuality in 1953 had found very high levels of premarital sex and extramarital sex, and also of homosexuality among both men and women. So that for the first time, there was some sort of pseudo-scientific support for the idea that this was actually a society where there was far more sex going on than had previously been officially recognized. In 1953, Hugh Hefner brought out the first edition of Playboy. promoting a hedonistic philosophy of sex. The sex is something recreational and entertaining, and that you ought not to think of it as being solely confined to marriage. In 1962, Helen Gurley Brown published Sex and the Single Girl. It isn't a book primarily about sex. It's primarily a book of advice to young women on how they need to get careers of their own, how they need to establish their own independence, how to get ahead in their careers and lives without being propped up by a man. But it did include the frank reference to the fact that they might have sex lives independent of marriage. Helen Gurley Brown herself later became the very successful editor of another journal, Cosmopolitan. And this was a journal which pioneered in having naked men in the centerfold as the kind of polar opposite of, or the mirror image of Playboy. Burt Reynolds in 1972 was the first of these men. The sexual revolution had certainly been greatly facilitated by the perfection of the pill, the contraceptive pill, in the early 1960s. Because that was a technology which really did make it possible to reliably separate sex from procreation if it was used properly. Also during the 1960s, there was a great deal of concern about the population explosion, the idea that the Earth's population was growing at a terrifying rate, and that if something wasn't done to curtail it, catastrophic Malthusian problems would follow. That's why it was possible to view the widespread use of the pill as socially benign. You know, it's a necessary way of constraining the population explosion. In 1968, the Roman Catholic Church also went into convulsions when the Pope, Paul VI, issued the encyclical letter Humanae Vitae, in which he upheld the Catholic Church's traditional teaching against the use of artificial contraceptives. His view was, sex is a gift from God, and to have sex in which your intention is not procreative is turning away from God in an insulting way. But certainly most of the Catholic people, knowing that a statement was on the way and expecting that it would be endorsing the pill, were horrified to discover it was just the opposite. Meanwhile, during the 60s and early 1970s, the taboo on cohabitation outside of marriage and of childbearing outside of marriage broke down very, very rapidly. So what would have been regarded with absolute horror in the early 60s in the American middle classes was regarded as entirely commonplace by the mid-1970s. Even more dramatic was a transformation of the legal and social view of abortion, which in 1973 was permitted in the Supreme Court's decision of the Roe versus Wade case. Now, originally, America's anti-abortion laws had been passed in the late 19th century, at a time when Catholics already had a very, very strong prohibition against abortion. But the Protestant churches had never really commented on it. And most of the lobbying energy for anti-abortion laws had come from Protestant groups, afraid that otherwise the Catholic population was going to outstrip theirs, that the Protestant birth rate was falling behind, and the Catholics were having a lot of kids. And so this was in a time, obviously, of great anti-Catholic prejudice. Therefore, we've got to keep pace with them. And yet, by the early 1970s, the first group to take a prominent stand against this transformation of the abortion laws was itself Roman Catholic. The reason this had developed was it came partly out of all the changes we've been looking at, and partly out of the Sherry Finkbein case. This is from 1962. She was a mother. Sherry Finkbein was a mother of four living in Arizona. Her husband brought back to her from a business trip to Europe a sleeping pill called thalidomide. But thalidomide had been linked to severe birth defects among European women. And when she realized that she'd been taking this pill and that she was pregnant and that it might lead to a severe deformity in the child to which she would give birth, she told her doctor what had happened, and he counseled her to get what was then called a therapeutic abortion. She told one of her friends, who was a journalist, about how this whole situation had developed, and her friend published the story in the local newspaper. Well, to Finkbein's horror and amazement, there was a great outcry against her from people who said, you must give birth to your child anyway. The child isn't yours to dispose of or not as you wish. An abortion is tantamount to infanticide. Well, this was one of the cases which brought abortion into the public spotlight and led to an intense debate around it. Radical feminists in the late 60s and early 70s were campaigning for reproductive freedom. That is, the absolute right to decide such issues for themselves, rather than being instructed by doctors, as had been the convention until then. And they thought of abortion as a right, which was then an entirely new concept. The idea of abortion rights is itself language which comes out of the early 1970s. Certainly, they were delighted by the breadth of Roe versus Wade in 1973, just as the opponents of abortion, who thought of it as being the equivalent of infanticide, were horrified by it. Also in 1969, the gay liberation movement began, and it too made analogous claims to that of the civil rights movement and the feminists. Homosexuals began to say, we're also members of a minority. We also are discriminated against in employment, certainly in social conduct. We're a despised minority, and we ought not to be. We ought to have legal recognition of our status as well. The famous incident there precipitating the movement was the Stonewall Riot of 1969, when the patrons of a gay bar in New York, instead of fleeing when a police raid came up, as happened periodically, stayed to fight against the police. It was an act of assertion, and for them this act of violence was almost as important as the non-violence that the African-American community had shown in the early days of the civil rights movement. From then on, the question of coming out became a central issue among homosexuals. That is, should you declare publicly that you are homosexual? And ethically more controversial, should you out other people? That is, if you know that someone influential and important who could help your cause is homosexual but won't admit it publicly, should you out them? In other words, should you announce that they are in fact homosexual and kind of force them into the open on your side? That's remained a controversial question right up to the present. Until 1973, American psychiatrists and psychologists regarded homosexuality as a kind of mental illness. But in 1973, they struck that off their list of recognizable mental afflictions. And in fact, by the end of the 20th century, homophobia had become the affliction, the idea of identifying homosexuals as deplorable. So a very rapid shift in the popular perception of homosexuals. In the early 1980s, the identification of AIDS also intensified the traumatic public policy debates which went on, particularly around homosexuals, though also around intravenous drug users. Well, all these very, very rapid changes in society between the early 60s and 1980 led to a sharp backlash, an anti-feminist backlash. Phyllis Schlafly is the great figure here. She was the leader of the campaign called Stop ERA. And she's a woman whose own life is full of paradoxes. When she was a college student during the Second World War, she paid her way through college by working in a machine gun factory, test firing the guns. She was the mother of six, the wife of a lawyer, herself a highly qualified and well-educated person, a lobbyist, and so on. In many ways, seemed to fit the profile of the woman who can do it all, the feminist career woman. But in fact, she thought it was horrifying that feminists should be pressuring for the transformation of the society, and that she did what she could to stop it. The Equal Rights Amendment, which would have abolished gender distinction, passed through Congress in 1972 and seemed likely to become part of the Constitution. An amendment needs the ratification of three-quarters of the state governments, which by then meant 38 states. Very quickly it got 35 of them, but then Schlafly did everything she could to prevent the last states from ratifying. And she created a very, very effective grassroots lobbying organization, particularly of women who didn't work, moms who stayed at home. She said, if we're not careful, women are going to have to act in America like they do in the Soviet Union. They're going to have to go into combat, just like the Russian women did in the Second World War. We're going to have unisex bathrooms. And the idea that all this is going to be enforced by the federal government is going to vastly expand federal power, which is already too great. She was a right-wing Republican and didn't like the increasing reach of the government ever since the New Deal period. So gradually, her lobbyists were able to restrict the ratification of the ERA, with the result that it never was incorporated into the American Constitution, because several of the states that had ratified it, under intense pressure, de-ratified. It remained controversial as to whether a state could in fact do that. Meanwhile, she herself was passionately opposed to abortion, and more religious groups became involved in the pro-life or anti-abortion movement as well. Making powerful analogies, pro-life advocates said, in the Dred Scott case of 1857, an entire category of American people were discriminated against, denied legal standing because of their race. Now an entire category of people is being excluded because of their age, because they haven't yet reached the moment of birth. But they clearly are human beings, and therefore America is actually killing large numbers of its own people at their most defenseless age. The analogy with the Holocaust was also irresistible. Just as the Nazis discriminated against a whole group of people, not for anything that they had done, but objectively because of who they were, so now America's doing the same thing. And the American Holocaust is reaching almost the dimensions of the Nazi one. Powerful and effective arguments to make. And through the 1980s, organizations like Operation Rescue worked very hard to try to put intense pressure on abortion providers and also to get a rolling back of the legal situation. Well, during the 1960s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, women's participation in the workforce became more widespread than ever. But in an unforeseen side effect, it also became more necessary than ever before. After all, if you've suddenly got a far greater workforce, that tends to mean an oversupply of labour, which in turn tends to mean a decline in pay. So what's happened in the last 40 years is that family incomes have continued to rise in America, but very often only because both partners are now working. Whereas in the 50s, it was very common for a working man, even a working class man, an auto worker, to make an income sufficient for his whole family. By the close of the 20th century, it was necessary for both partners to be working in order for the continued rise in standards of living to be maintained. So it's something of a mixed blessing. By the year 2000, even the religious conservatives, the pro-life advocates, the anti-feminists, most of those women from those families also were having to go to work, but not because they'd wanted to in the Betty Friedan tradition, but because now it was a matter of economic necessity.